Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum webinar, A Seat at the City. Today, our panel of experts will discuss the January 2022 sitting of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President, General Counsel of the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program. Also, they're expressing their personal views, not necessarily the views of their employers or their affiliated institutions. As well, this program is being recorded, will likely be transcribed, and is subject to future broadcast. To give you a sense of the format, we're going to get opening remarks from our experts covering each of the cases we're discussing today, seven cases in all. We're covering them in the order they're going to be argued in the court. After that, we'll have questions and answers among the panelists, but also questions from the floor, from you, the viewers. So please use the raise hand function when we get to that portion of the program. Our speakers today include Professor Susanna Sherry. She is the Herman O. Lowenstein Professor of Law Emerita at Vanderbilt Law School. She's also covering Castier for SCOTUS blog. We're also joined by Professor Eugene Bollock. He's the Gary T. Schwartz Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA Law School and the founder of the famed Bollock Conspiracy and a specialist in First Amendment law. We're joined as well by Professor Ilya Soman. He's a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, and relevant to his remarks today and the cases he's covering, he's the author of a book on immigration law published in 2022 and entitled Free to Move, Foot Migration, Voting, and Political Freedom. That's available everywhere. But first up, Sarah Harris is a partner at Williams & Connolly, a frequent Supreme Court litigator, and her next appearance before the court is in the oral argument sitting in February. So we're very pleased to welcome all four of our panelists today. We look forward to a great discussion. We're going to bounce around a little bit between our panelists. So we're taking the cases in order they're being argued. They're going to give us 5 to 7 minutes or so on each case. But as I mentioned, be thinking about your questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Sarah Harris, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Dean, and the Federalist Society for welcoming me back to this program, despite not being a professor for this one. I'm going to kick it off by discussing cases that you all may have been following. Probably the most high-profile set of cases of the sitting, which is, of course, the cases about the vaccine mandate. So tomorrow is a really big day at the Supreme Court. They are hearing back-to-back expedited arguments in two sets of cases. First of all is the OSHA rule. And the question there is whether the Supreme Court should stay the OSHA vaccine or test mandate, whereby every employer with more than 100 employees must either ensure that all of those employees have been vaccinated or monitor compliance with weekly tests and mask requirements for unvaccinated employees. If you don't comply and you're an employer who is subject to this, you face very, very big fines, $13,500 per violation and up to $140,000 per willful or repeated violation, as well as the possibility of a federal court injunction forcing you to do all this stuff. So the emergency rule issued on November 5th with an effective date of January 10th. And there are sort of sweep questions in that case about, can OSHA do this? It's a pretty sweeping power. Can they do it? The second case the court's going to hear is a related requirement for healthcare workers, which is whether the Supreme Court should stay a federal rule mandating that all healthcare workers who participate in the Medicare or Medicaid programs must be vaccinated absent religious objection. There, the government is claiming authority under the Medicare and Medicaid statutes and saying that it has a lot of leeway as a condition of participation in those programs to require providers to comply with programs to prevent infectious diseases. I will focus on the OSHA rule. I think that's gotten the brunt of people's attention, perhaps because it affects 2/3 of all private sector workers and about 80 million people. But I'll just sort of, to avoid bearing the lead, let me say at the outset, the conventional wisdom right now among people who follow the court, I think it's safe to say, is that the court is likely to stay the OSHA rule on the grounds that indicate the rule exceeds OSHA's statutory authority and probably can't be salvaged. But if I had to, you know, make an assessment of betting right now, if people betted on Supreme Court outcomes, there's sort of a consensus among people who talk about this that the court will likely allow the healthcare worker mandate to proceed. And I think right, and again, these are not like, don't go out and bet, don't go bet the house on these predictions, but that's just kind of the sense of folks right now from following the briefing. There will be, I'm sure, a reassessment depending on how argument goes tomorrow. But there is sort of a feeling of the court maybe wanting to split the baby on some of these cases, and also a sense that perhaps the court will give the government more leeway when regulating things like the Medicare and Medicaid program. So let me just talk a little more about how the OSHA rule got to the Supreme Court, because it's really unusual. With apologies to Winston Churchill, I think the lower court litigation can be summed up as follows, which is, never in the field of administrative law has so much litigation been generated by so many in so few days. Immediately after OSHA announced its emergency rule in November, there is a huge rush of filings in every circuit, which again, I think reflects that this affects 80 million people, and employers by and large thought that this would be just enormously burdensome and disruptive. So the statute under which OSHA did this has a rule that one circuit will entertain all of the challenges and that it will be picked by lottery. But even before that lucky circuit got picked, the Fifth Circuit resolved one of the stay applications and concluded that the rule likely likely exceeded OSHA's authority, which meant that the rule was then at that point stayed. Then the Sixth Circuit won the circuit lottery, rejected calls for initial rehearing en banc, so the full court wasn't going to hear this challenge. That was a very close vote. Judge Sutton wrote the lead dissent from that procedural order and sort of tipped the hand that the Sixth Circuit panel deciding the stay of the OSHA mandate was unlikely to be, was unlikely to side with the Fifth Circuit, because Judge Sutton's dissent really just goes into the merits of the OSHA rule and gives a lot of reasons in advance why he thought that it exceeded OSHA's authority, why there were constitutional problems with it, et cetera. And then lo and behold, very shortly thereafter, the Sixth Circuit panel, with a dissent from Judge Larson, then vacated the Fifth Circuit's rule, let the OSHA mandate rule proceed, and then everyone went up to the Supreme Court really fast asking for a stay there. So in the normal course, the Supreme Court, when faced with that kind of stay request, ordinarily will ask for briefing on the stay and issue a one-line order, either granting or denying the stay. Sometimes there'll be a short opinion, but even that's pretty unusual. Instead, things got really interesting when things got to the court. The court took the unusual course on December 22nd of scheduling arguments on the stay motions for January 7th, even before the stay briefing was done. That's a big deal. I think you could probably surmise it might in part reflect some of the criticisms about the so-called shadow docket, whether or not that's the right term. I think the court has been very sensitive about all of the focus on what it's doing on these stays, and scheduling argument on a stay motion sure is a good way of shutting down some of that criticism. So the court picked two cases to hear out of dozens of petitions. One of them is the National Federation of Independent Businesses application, and the other one is a petition and an application filed by Ohio and a total of 27 states. So you might ask, why those two? Why the two lucky winners of the Supreme Court? I think the best reason is the court probably wanted to avoid some tricky questions about nationwide injunctions. And by picking those two cases, the court can effectively grant nationwide relief if that's where it goes, because the private company, the private petitioners are trade groups in every state, and there's 27 states to kind of cover everything else. So let me kind of quickly go through the merits of the arguments just to give an overview of what's going on. The parties are focused on statutory and constitutional arguments at this point, and the brunt of it is really an OSHA provision authorizing an emergency temporary standard if employees are exposed to grave danger from exposure to substances or agents determined to be toxic or physically harmful or from new hazards. And the emergency standard is necessary to protect employees from such danger. So the petitioner's theme is sort of, this is an unprecedented federal power grab for two reasons. One is something called the major questions doctrine, and it kind of boils down to the idea that it's not plausible that Congress put the enormous elephant of giving OSHA sweeping control over the economy through a vaccine and testing mandate through what is sort of a mouthful of a statutory provision. Justice Kavanaugh, I would just flag, has been very big on this doctrine since his time in the DC Circuit. So I can see the petitioners really wanting to appeal to him and probably the chief in particular with this one. And the second line of argument is about the non-delegation doctrine, which is getting pretty hot right now. I think it's really enjoying a renaissance of interest among the justices. And the argument there is just, if you were to read this statutory provision to give OSHA the authority to decide how to respond to the pandemic, that's giving an obscure agency without much healthcare expertise a vast power that the petitioners say only Congress should exercise. The government, on the other hand, has the theme of this rule is essential to save lives, that Congress gave OSHA really, really broad power over all sorts of things that affect the workplace, including vaccine requirements, without regard for economic consequences. And the government kind of poo-poos the non-delegation concern and says, look, OSHA has to decide that the standards are necessary to protect against dangers. They have to make findings about the level of harm, et cetera. That is certainly good enough, the government says, for the non-delegation doctrine. So what to expect at argument? I think it's going to be a fun case to listen to, not only an important one. I think there's going to be a lot of hypotheticals to flesh out the boundaries of what authority OSHA may or may not have. For the petitioners, I think there will be lots of tweaks on, well, what if OSHA just had done a mask mandate? What if they simply provided that employers must comply with their state or locality's COVID policies? You know, what are the meets and bounds? Why is it the case that the vaccine or test requirement in particular goes too far? Can they at least do something? And for the government, I think it'll be conversely hypotheticals about what limiting principle there is on OSHA's ability to reach into choices beyond the workplace. So for instance, if let's say there were evidence that people who are overweight are more likely to spread COVID or have more serious COVID, could OSHA then mandate a weight loss program? That's a hard argument. You know, that's a hard hypo for someone. I think the other current is that the reality now is obviously CDC is recommending booster shots, and there are questions about what to do about Omicron, what is the best response to that, how effective are vaccines if you just do the two vaccines against Omicron, what about future variants? So the government's probably going to get asked, you know, isn't OSHA going to have to revise the rules substantially in all events to account for later developments? And just one more thing on the OSHA mandate before I get to the sort of next case I'm going to cover, because I'm sure we can discuss, you know, consequences and questions later on. What's the court going to resolve? Even though the state posture, this is a state posture, I do think it's likely the court's going to want to resolve the merits. It's sort of strange if they would have taken this case for expedited argument just to opine on like the irreparable harm standard. So I do think whatever the court says on the merits, it is very likely to define the contours of what OSHA can or cannot do down the road in this sort of field. Okay, so the next case I'm covering is the next argument the court will hear. It'll be on Monday, January 10th, but it's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum because it is, instead of being a big picture question about agency power, it's a gem of a statutory interpretation case called Gallardo versus Marsteller. It's probably a 10 out of 10 on degree of difficulty in terms of Supreme Court cases and involves the Medicaid statute, which is no one's idea of clearly written or easy to follow, to such an extent that Justice Breyer recently joked in another Medicaid case this term by prefacing a question with the caveat, quote, do I understand this correctly? The chances I understand this correctly are near zero. The statutory appendices in this case are just really long, and the provisions at issue have names like 1396A, 25A1. So what's the question in the case? It's kind of a practical one. It is, let's say a Medicaid enrollee requires significant medical care. Medicaid pays for the care at the outset, let's say it's like surgery. And the person also has future medical expenses. The person reaches a settlement with a third party who caused that person's injuries, and the settlement covers both past and future medical expenses. The question in this case is, under the Medicaid Act, can the state recoup its expenses from the portion of the settlement attributable to future expenses, or is it restricted to the portion attributable to past medical expenses? Which sounds very technical, but actually ends up being a huge amount of money for state Medicaid programs. That's why it's a really important case, I think, just in terms of the bottom line. The Supreme Court's kind of cleared away some of the brush in this area of law by holding in previous cases that states cannot take money out of settlements that is representing other things that aren't medical expenses. So if the state has medical expenses to cover for Medicaid, you can't say, take it out of the pot of money for pain and suffering or loss of consortium. But this case is really the one that says, what kind of medical expenses can the state dip into to get reimbursed? And it's a war of competing provisions. The petitioner points to one principal provision about the state's subrogation rights over the Medicaid enrollees' recovery from third parties. It's written in the past tense. Petitioner says it clearly limits the state to the pool of settlement funds attributable only to past expenses. And then Florida, on the other hand, points to another key provision about assignment to the state of the enrollees' right to recovery from third parties that doesn't have those similar limitations and seems much broader. So it's going to be, I think, a neat case for the court, just as a straight up statutory interpretation issue of which provision should dominate. How do you read the other contextual clues? The petitioner is supported by the United States, and there may be some play in the court. Florida has said that the United States has slipped position, so the government may get some heat on that. And there's also some sort of fun subplots if you are interested in nerdy statutory interpretation with respect to whether the government's claim for Chevron deference is going to get some backlash from the court, which is, I think, increasingly skeptical of Chevron deference. So no prediction on the outcome here, but this is the kind of case where I suspect the justices may be very unevenly engaged. Some of them love this kind of case, and I think others may have been exhausted by the vaccine mandate and content to let their brethren pick up the baton in questioning here. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ilya for further along in the sitting.
Thank you. I just want to make sure everyone can hear me. And unless somebody speaks up that you cannot, I'm going to press on. My task today is to talk about two technical immigration law cases that will be argued later in January. And the nature of these cases, which both address basically the same statutory issue, may seem highly technical, but it does also relate to some broader issues with respect to both immigration law and its status under the Constitution, and also the issue of prolonged detention without trial. So the two cases are Johnson versus Arteaga-Martinez, which comes from the Third Circuit. And the second one is Garland versus Gonzalez, which comes from the Ninth Circuit. In the case of the Third Circuit decision, what is really being reviewed is not Johnson versus Arteaga-Martinez itself, but rather an earlier case decided previously in 3 years ago, called Guerrero Sanchez versus York County Prison, because the more recent Third Circuit decision simply relies on the 2018 decision. It's just a couple sentence order, which says everybody agrees that the 2018 decision controls this one. So somewhat confusingly, the real Third Circuit decision being reviewed is not the one that's officially being reviewed. And both of these decisions deal with detention under a statute called 8 U.S.C. Section 1231, which states that the Attorney General shall remove an alien from the United States within a period of 90 days when an alien is ordered removed for certain reasons, but also states that the alien who's ordered removed may be detained beyond a removal period in certain circumstances. It does not specifically say whether the people being detained in this way are entitled to a bond hearing to determine whether they should be released as opposed to be detained, released on bond, but it does contemplate the possibility that they may be released. And if they are released, then they're subject to certain terms of supervision, which is in another provision of 8 U.S.C. Section 1231. So the question is whether people detained under this statute have the right to seek a bond hearing in which the government would have to prove that they're dangerous or a threat to the community or the like before being able to continue to detain them. If they can't prove that, then they could be released on bond. And Both the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit concluded that there is, in fact, a right to this bond hearing. If the person has been detained much longer than the removal period, they concluded that this is 180 days. And you might ask, why are people detained longer than the time during which, in principle, they're supposed to be removed? It's because many of the people detained actually have legal challenges to their removal, which they're pursuing, and the nature of the immigration court system is that often such challenges take many months, in some cases even years, to adjudicate. So these people are pursuing legal rights that they have to challenge their detention and removal, but the resolution of those challenges can take a long time because of the structure of the system. There are a number of technical issues also at stake in these cases, which I'm skipping over partly for considerations of time and partly because I don't want to bore people too much. For example, the Ninth Circuit is under the actually a preliminary injunction. So there are some issues there whether certain preliminary injunction standards have been met. But the core issue is whether the government can detain these people indefinitely without giving them a bond hearing. Both the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit said that the statute is sufficiently ambiguous on whether it requires such a bond hearing or not, that the canon of constitutional avoidance applies. What is the canon of constitutional avoidance? It is a longstanding rule of statutory interpretation, which says that if a statute is ambiguous, then if at all possible, courts should interpret it to avoid constitutional problems if there is an interpretation which avoids them. And in a case called Zedvitas in 2001, the Supreme Court ruled correctly, I think, that indefinite detention for an alien where it's not clear whether they actually will be removed or not, such indefinite detention at the very least raises serious constitutional problems under the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment, which among other things says that you cannot be detained without due process of law. And in this case, they're detaining people who haven't been convicted of anything, or at least are not being detained for the thing they were convicted for. Often the detention itself happens with very little due process of any kind. One of the notorious aspects of the immigration system is that people are detained often with very little due process. There's not a right to counsel in these hearings. There's little consideration of evidence and so on. The government is arguing that there is no constitutional problem here, and that the statute isn't ambiguous, and they're particularly relying on a decision called Jennings versus Rodriguez, decided in 2018 by the Supreme Court, which, among other things, reversed some previous Ninth Circuit decisions, which had required a bond hearing, not under Section 1231, but under Sections 1225 and 1226 of the same part of the U.S. Code. And they say, well, if there's no right to a bond hearing under those statutes, then it's clearly the case that there's no right under this one either. But the Third Circuit, I think, quite properly said there's a big difference between 1225 and 1226 on the one hand and 1231 on the other. And specifically, 1225 and 26 both say that the government, quote, shall detain the non-citizens in question. On the other hand, Section 1231 says merely that they may detain them and also contemplates possible release. I think this is a major textual distinction between these sections, and I think good reason to say that Jennings does not apply to Section 1231. The Supreme Court can, of course, decide that it does apply. They can do whatever they want, almost, but at least there is this very crucial textual distinction. And as I said before, the normal rule for the constitutional avoidance canon is that if it is at all possible to come up with a plausible interpretation of an ambiguous statute that doesn't raise constitutional problems, courts are required to pick that approach as opposed to one where There is constitutional problems. The Supreme Court, including in the famous case of NFIB versus Sebelius, actually said that when there's two plausible interpretations, the courts are supposed to choose the less plausible of the two if that one avoids constitutional problems, so long as the less plausible one is at least, somewhat minimally reasonably plausible. Now, there obviously are people who criticize that canon, and I'm not going to try to get into that debate here. I will merely say that so long as that canon remains in place, it should be applied to immigration law, no less than to any other area of law. And if it is applied to immigration law in the same way, then I think the Third Circuit decisions and the Ninth Circuit decisions should be upheld. And this gets us to the general issues at stake in these cases, which go beyond the specific details. One is the extent to which this will be another case where there could be a double standard between the way rules of constitutional law and statutory interpretation are applied everywhere else and the way that they're applied to immigration law. There's a wide range of areas where the Supreme Court essentially held that normal constitutional constraints on government power do not apply at all or do not apply with the same force to immigration restrictions. The Trump travel ban case from 2018 is the most famous recent decision like this, but there are others. And sadly, I think it's possible that this will be another case like that where they'll say that essentially the constitutional avoidance canon doesn't apply in this context to the same degree, or alternatively, maybe even the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment, which limits prolonged detention, maybe that doesn't apply in the same way. So I think there is a risk that that will happen, even though there is no textual or originalist basis for saying that immigration law is special in this way. For those who are interested, I published an article in The Atlantic going over these broader issues in greater detail back in 2019. I'm happy to talk about it in questions further, but I can't fully lay it out here. The second broader issue here is the general problem, which is not solely limited to immigration law, of detention without conviction or without much due process. This exists in other aspects of the criminal justice system, like with pretrial detention, but with immigration law, it's even worse, and the people are detained for long periods of time with very little due process. In the Guerrero-Sanchez case, which is the 2018 Third Circuit decision under review here, the person in question been detained for 637 days without any kind of hearing before the Third Circuit decided the case. And such prolonged detention with little or no due process, sadly, is not unusual in the immigration system. Similar problems exist in other contexts in the justice system, but the immigration system is perhaps the single most egregious offender. And I think this kind of prolonged detention with very little due process is something that should trouble people regardless of how they feel about immigration law generally or criminal justice generally, it's very easy to seriously harm people in this way. In the immigration detention system, data suggests that every year we detain hundreds or even thousands of actual U.S. citizens because there's so little due process that often the relevant government agencies don't figure out that the people are U.S. citizens until they've been in detention for hundreds of days, or in some cases until they've even been deported to Central America or elsewhere. So what will the court do? I don't know for sure. I think, however, there is a good likelihood they will overrule the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit. I think that for two reasons. One is when the Ninth Circuit sends a case up to the Supreme Court, it's always or very often very likely they'll get overruled. The second is, sadly, I think many, if not all, the conservative justices on the Supreme Court do accept the idea that there should be a double standard for immigration law, even though that double standard is not justified by the interpretive methodologies that they adopt in other cases. But I'm not far from completely certain about this prediction. I very much hope I'm wrong. Please, Supreme Court, prove me wrong on this. And there is a chance that the Supreme Court has really taken these cases because they think there is a circuit split. There is a Sixth Circuit decision called Hamani versus Adducci, which, depending on how you interpret it, could be seen as interpreting Section 1231A6 in a different way from the Third and the Ninth Circuit. But that circuit only, that decision only gives a very cursory treatment of the issue, and it's not easy to interpret. So more can be said, but for now I will leave off, and I look forward to possible questions. Thank you so much. And I turn it over to Eugene. I believe he's supposed to be next.
Me?
Yeah, Professor Bullock. Professor Bullock, go right ahead.
Sounds good. Sorry, it sounded a little odd. There was something wrong with the sound. So I am going to be talking right now about the case Shurtleff v. City of Boston case. It's an interesting case. I can't say the Republic will stand or fall on this one, but it's an interesting issue, and it has to do with flags flying in front of Boston City Hall. And as with many places, it has three flagpoles. One of them flies the US flag, and I believe underneath that may be the POW/MIA flag. Another flies the flag of the state, Massachusetts. The third flies, unsurprisingly often, the city flag, because this is Boston City Hall. But the city, on various occasions, has allowed the flying of other flags, including many foreign national flags, which the city justifies as a means of kind of signaling the ethnic diversity, the diversity of backgrounds of Boston residents. Although you could also imagine a city doing that just to signal kind of amity with a foreign country. And on occasion has also flown some flags having to do with various organizations, kind of identity group organizations, you can think of an identity group, think of it ideological. The most one that was most talked about is a gay pride flag. So the Shurtleff wanted to fly the Christian flag. I didn't know there was a Christian flag. I knew there were Christian lots of things, but I don't think it's in the Bible, the Christian flag. But there is such a thing, and he wanted to fly it, and the city said no, because it's a religious flag, and we don't want to fly those. And the question that ends up being relevant here is, when does speech of third parties that's displayed in government property and in a sense accepted by the government, when is it government speech? This is a question that has come up before, and it has ended up proving fairly thorny. And the reason this is important is government's choices of its own speech may be viewpoint-based. In fact, it ought to be viewpoint-based, right? If the government is speaking to endorse something, then presumably wants to endorse that thing and not something else. And even if it's speaking to endorse a bunch of things, it presumably wants to endorse those things that it likes and not those things that it dislikes. Of course, the classic case on this is Rust v. Sullivan, where the court said that it's okay, I oversimplify here, but basically it's okay for the government to fund various speech about contraception, but not speech about abortion. Why? Because it's the government speaking, and the government is entitled to speak in favor of one thing and not another, even though there it was speaking through grantees, not through government employees. On the other hand, if it isn't government speech, even if it's on government property, it would generally need to be, any restrictions in it would need to be viewpoint neutral, even in a so-called limited public forum, even in a non-public forum. So the government can't say, oh, the airport is government property and you can't wear racist t-shirts there, or you can't wear religious t-shirts there, because that would be impermissible viewpoint discrimination. The court had earlier said the discrimination against religious speech is viewpoint-based. So what has the court said about this in recent years? Well, one thing it said is monuments in public park are government speech. This happened in the Summum, the Pleasant Grove case. The city there accepted a bunch of private monuments, including like a Ten Commandments monument and various other monuments. So they were supplied by members of the public, but the court said the city, by accepting them and displaying them, makes them their own speech. It may not have been created by the city. In fact, the idea for it may not have come from the city, but the city accepts it, endorses it, presents it as its own. The court also said, much more controversially, in a 5-4 vote, that license plate designs, not individual personalized 7-letter and digit codes that people select for themselves, but license plate designs, are government speech, even though there the state of Texas allowed more than 350 privately submitted varieties. The court said, because they are government speech, the government can say, well, we're not going to authorize a Confederate flag design. Since then, the court has said this likely marks the outer bounds of the government speech doctrine. And the 5-justice majority was then 4 liberals and Justice Thomas. So now the death of Justice Ginsburg, it's possible that even if Justice Thomas goes along with the liberals in this case and thinks that this is similar to Walker, maybe Walker will get reversed. Or in any event, a later case, Mattel v. Tam, did say that Walker is kind of, it goes about as far as the court is willing to go. On the other hand, in Mattel v. Tam, and in a follow-on case called Yonker v. Brunetti, the court said trademark registrations, even though they're issued by the government and listed in the trademark register that's run by the government and the like, those are not government speech. Those are private speech. And there the government can't discriminate based on viewpoints. So it can, for example, ban marks that it views as racially offensive. Like, for example, in that case that involved the Slants, which was an Asian American band, was trying to reclaim a term that had historically been at times used as a slur against Asians. The Patent Trademark Office said no, and the court said, nope, this is private speech, albeit through government benefits program. The government has to be viewpoint neutral. So the factors the court has identified in Walker and earlier in some measure in Summum and then applied in Mattel, talk about three things: the history of communicating government messages, whether that particular medium had been used this way, whether it's identified in the public mind with the government, and whether the state maintains direct control over what messages to allow, what's called selective receptivity, is what the court referred to it in Summum. Interestingly, if you look at it in Walker, it's pretty uncertain which way this should cut. And that's perhaps one reason this was 5-4. The factor 3 is almost always present in these kinds of situations because the government does have control over it, after all, its own property. Question: should it have control, unlimited control, or should the control be limited? The first two factors, I think, might distinguish matters in some measure. I don't think people historically have viewed trademarks as communicating government messages. They communicate private messages, even if the government buttresses them. Monuments and public parks pretty clearly have conveyed public messages. What about license plate designs? That's a harder call. By the way, one reason I put up this picture is I think this is a good picture for the city, right? Flagpoles in front of government buildings historically communicate government messages. All the time, 2/3 of them communicate government messages. Some of the time, 3/3 do. And this looks a lot more like a monument, even though it's not permanent, than I think, certainly like a trademark. Now, one important factor in favor of the challengers is that there is this policy which talks about what are the reasons a request could be denied, talks about accommodating all applicants. And the argument is that involves the government creating by design a limited public forum. Whatever it might have done with regard to its policy, it did set up a policy that creates a limited public forum. So there's actually a big dispute in the briefs about exactly what the policy says. You look at the top of the slide, one excerpt from the policy talks about guidelines for people requesting the use of city hall flagpoles. What events are covered though? Public events proposed to take place at the city hall flagpoles. And then on the left, there's another portion from the same policy, which talks about public events at certain properties. These locations include at the flagpole. So the city is saying, look, what we really meant was we want to accommodate all applicants who want to have a demonstration at the flagpoles, but that doesn't mean, and when we say or the city's hall flagpoles, we didn't mean it to mean the flagpoles themselves. So if you want to have pro-religious or pro-anything speech or anti-anything speech by the flagpoles, absolutely, of course, we need to allow that. In fact, that may be a traditional public forum, certainly at least a designated public forum. But the flagpoles themselves, their content is not that. Let me just close by another picture. So one of these things is not like the other one. That's the upper left-hand corner. That is the Christian flag. Those, of course, familiar with flags or familiar with the history of civilization know that a lot of flags have Christian symbolism. Now, by the way, I haven't found any national flags that have what's sometimes called the Latin cross, the one which looks like a lowercase t. But lots of them have crosses. So the one on the upper right-hand corner, similar color scheme, T on the side, perhaps that's the Icelandic flag. The next one down in the middle of the left-hand column, I didn't deliberately use the Swiss flag because everybody knows that one. This is the flag of Tonga. The next flag is the flag of Georgia. The country, not the state. The one on the lower left-hand corner, obviously the flag of Israel, although obviously it also has the predominant symbol of Judaism. And the one in the lower right-hand corner is the flag of Pakistan, which of course also displays the predominant symbol of Islam. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, that the Christian flag is necessarily just like all the others. You could say, well, those are national flags and that one is not. But my guess is if somebody sees the Christian flag flying up there, most people will say, oh, it's the flag of some country. I don't know which one, but there are 200, who knows? A few people might say, oh, wait a minute, it's the Christian flag. Are we saying that Boston is endorsing Christianity? But then what they could do is they just send an email to Boston saying, we're outraged you're endorsing Christianity. And then Boston could respond, at least if the Supreme Court says that it has to allow this flag, could respond saying, well, sorry, you know, we're not endorsing Christianity. This is just a limited public forum. And the reason I bring up the other flags, that's exactly what will happen if somebody sees the Pakistani flag and says, wait a minute, why is Boston endorsing Islam, or sees the Georgian flag? Why is Boston endorsing Christianity? And Boston would respond saying, you know, we're not endorsing that. We're showing amity to those countries or support for Bostonians who come from those countries. So that's another reason why I think there's relatively little substantively at stake here. But doctrinally, it proves to be an important and interesting question.
That will turn to Professor Suzanne Sherry. Eugene, I assume you were finished on
that. Yes, I'm sorry, I'm done.
Okay, great. Professor Sherry.
Thank you, and I need a slide. Can you see the slide? There, okay, thank you. The beautiful Impressionist painting that you're looking at is Rue Saint-Honoré, Afternoon Rain Effects. It was painted by Camille Pissarro in 1897, and it was purchased in 1900 by Paul Cassirer, a prominent German Jewish art collector. And in 1939, it was expropriated by the Nazis from Paul's heir, Lily Cassirer, in exchange for permission for her to leave Germany. She did leave Germany some of her family members, including her grandson, Claude, and they both emigrated to the United States. Sadly, her other family members did not leave and were murdered in the camps. The Cassirers and the post-war German government lost track of the painting. Everybody assumed it had either been lost or destroyed during the war, although Lily and then Claude never stopped looking for it. But the painting had not been lost. Instead, it was sold to a California art dealer in 1951, and it spent the next 25 years in the United States, in California, New York, and Missouri. And then in 1976, it was purchased by a Swiss national, Baron Hans Heinrich von Thyssen-Bornemisza. And everybody calls him the Baron in the lower court opinions and the court papers because nobody knows how to pronounce it. And in 1992, the Baron and the Kingdom of Spain together established a new museum in Madrid called the Thyssen-Bornemisza Collection, usually called TBC. And the Baron sold the Pissarro and most of the rest of his collection to TBC. In 1999, 60 years after it was stolen by the Nazis, Claude Cassirer found the painting listed in a TBC catalog. For the next 6 years, he tried to get it back using diplomatic channels and an official petition to Spain, but to no avail. So in 2005, he brought suit against Spain and the TBC in federal court in California, where he had lived for the previous 25 years, alleging various state common law claims like conversion and unlawful possession, and asking both for damages and to get the painting back. That was 2005. This case has been in litigation ever since. In the meantime, it's been up to the Ninth Circuit and back four times. Cert has been denied twice. The Kingdom of Spain was dismissed voluntarily, leaving only TBC as the defendant, and Claude died. So it is now being litigated by his heirs, including David Cassiero. The only question left after all of these trips to various courts is whether the claims should be governed by California law or by Spanish law. And they're different. Under California law, a thief can never take or pass on valid title. So the Cassiero family still owns the painting. The Nazis stole it. They didn't have valid title. They couldn't pass valid title on to any of the subsequent purchasers, including TBC. Under Spanish law, however, a purchaser of stolen property can obtain title through essentially adverse possession, as long as the purchaser doesn't have actual knowledge that the property is stolen, and as long as it holds the property openly for at least 6 years. And the district court found after a bench trial that both those conditions were met. Although it also found that although TBC didn't actually know that it was stolen, both the Baron and TBC ignored some red flags about the provenance that they maybe should have investigated. But the Supreme Court isn't even deciding whether California or Spanish law applies. Instead, it's deciding how to decide that question. In other words, what choice of law doctrines should govern? Now, if Cassiero had found the painting in a private museum in Spain and sued the owner of that museum, or sued that museum in diversity jurisdiction under Section 1332, the answer would have been very easy. Because in 1941, Supreme Court held in Claxon versus Stenter Manufacturing that a federal court has to apply the choice of law doctrines of the state in which it sits, in this case, California. So California choice of law doctrines would apply. In other words, a federal court has to apply the same choice of law doctrines that a state court would apply in that state. The wrinkle here is that TBC is an instrumentality of a foreign sovereign. Remember, it was established in part by Spain. So TBC is an instrumentality of a foreign sovereign, and the case therefore could not be brought under 1332 diversity jurisdiction, but instead had to be brought under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, or the FSIA. The FSIA does two things that are relevant to this case. First of all, it strips immunity for suits from sovereigns that for suits that are brought for expropriation in violation of international law, which is why this case can go forward at all. And second, it confers jurisdiction on federal courts for suits against foreign sovereigns where the sovereign is not immune, again, like this case. What it doesn't do is specify what choice of law doctrines should apply. Now, four circuits have held that Claxon answers the question. Four circuits would say that just as it would apply, just as California choice of law doctrines would apply in a diversity case, California choice of law doctrines would govern this FSIA case. But the Ninth Circuit is different, and it's alone. Ninth Circuit precedent applies federal common law choice of law doctrines to determine which law governs in an FSIA case. And both the district court and the Court of Appeals held that those doctrines dictate applying Spanish law, not California law. The common law choice of law doctrines, by the way, were crafted by the Ninth Circuit in earlier FSIA cases, because there's no other circumstance under which federal choice of law doctrines apply to state causes of action. So what it comes down to is the meaning of the Federal Sovereign Immunities Act. Cassirer's main argument comes from the language, which says that when a foreign sovereign is not immune, and I'm now quoting, the foreign state shall be liable in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances. And Kassira's argument is because the private gallery that was in possession of this stolen art would be governed by California choice of law doctrines, then so should the TBC. TBC's main argument comes from a sort of a larger context of the SSIA rather than its language, although they have a way to distinguish the language. What TBC argues is that when Congress enacted the FSIA, it took foreign states out of diversity jurisdiction. Before the enactment of the FSIA, foreign states, to the extent that they could be sued at all, the suit was brought under diversity jurisdiction, 1332. And when Congress enacted the FSIA, they instead took foreign states out of diversity jurisdiction and created a new jurisdictional statute, section 1330. And what TBC argues is that both the legislative history and the purpose of the statute make 1330, this new jurisdictional statute, more analogous to federal question jurisdiction under 1331 than to diversity jurisdiction under 1332. So federal law should govern, as it does in federal question cases. The TBC also argues that applying federal choice of law doctrines accomplishes the FSIA's goal of creating uniform standards in suits against foreign sovereigns. I think it's going to be either 9-0 or 8-1 in favor of the petitioner. That is, I think the court will rule that the lower courts should have applied California choice of law doctrines. And the reasons I come to this conclusion, there are three. First of all, they did not grant cert in the other four circuits, right? It's 4-1. Second, I think the textual argument is both stronger and more appealing than TBC's contextual argument. And finally, something that the briefs don't play up, but I think may play a pretty big role in it, is that the court has made very clear in prior cases.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.
Federal law should govern rather than state law are very few and far between. But there is one last wrinkle. In an abundance of caution, the district court applied both federal common law choice of law doctrines and California choice of law doctrines, and it concluded that both federal choice of law doctrines and California choice of law doctrines both mandated the application of Spanish law. Now, the Ninth Circuit didn't review the holding under California law. That is, the Ninth Circuit did not review the district court's holding that California choice of law doctrines led to the application of Spanish law, because following its own precedent, the Ninth Circuit said you don't even need to look at California choice of law doctrines, you look at federal choice of law doctrines. So the court probably won't decide, the Supreme Court probably won't decide what California's choice of law doctrines demand. They'll remand it to the Ninth Circuit either to apply California choice of law doctrines or to review the district court's application of California choice of law doctrines. And if I were representing the Kassirers, I would ask the Ninth Circuit to certify that question to the California Supreme Court, because I suspect that the Ninth Circuit, having been reversed on its conclusion that federal choice of law doctrines apply and mandate the application of Spanish law, we'll simply reaffirm the same result by affirming the district court's finding that California choice of law doctrines also require the application of Spanish law. So I think that ultimately, even if the Kassirers win in the Supreme Court, which I think they will, it will be a Pyrrhic victory. And I'm happy to take questions, but with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Eugene for the last case.
Thanks. So the last case is FEC versus Ted Cruz for Senate campaign. And let me pull up the proper slide deck for that. FEC v. Ted Cruz for Senate has to do with a very specific feature of federal election campaign law. That has to do with limits on repayment of personal loans given by the candidate to the campaign. The federal statute says that candidate loans to campaign, and we're talking here about federal campaigns, cannot be repaid by the campaign to the extent they exceed $250,000 from any contributions made to such candidate after the date of such election. The regulations elaborate on this and then limit it in certain measure. They say the campaign may repay up to $250,000 from any contributions, pre-election or post, may use pre-election funds to repay the portion of the candidate loans that exceeds $250,000 only if the repayment occurs within 20 days after the election, and must not repay the amount beyond the $250,000 from contributions made after the date of the election. So let's say I'm running for federal office, laughable prospect, but let's say this were so. And I realize that I'm not getting as much money coming in as I'd like. But I want to get elected. So I loan my campaign $400,000. Then the election happens and I want the money back to the extent there's money available. Well, I could get the entire $400,000 if it all comes from pre-election contributions. But if some of it comes from post-election contributions, which is, I'm told, not uncommon, especially if I win, and then may be influenced by the fact that people want to be on my good side, there might be some post-election contributions. And then if I want to use those, I can't really use it for the amount past the $250,000. So I can use it for the $250,000, but I can't use it for the remaining $150,000. Maybe if there's enough money before the election, let's say there's $150,000 in the campaign's coffers, I could say, oh, pay me back with, it shouldn't say before the election, at the election date. Pay me back from the pre-election contributions, the $150,000, and then the remaining $250,000, I might be able to get compensated from post-election. So this is the accountants need to do their work. They'll get paid. A candidate can often get reimbursed, but this is a limit on such reimbursements. And unsurprisingly, as with any kinds of restrictions on money in election campaigns, it may in some measure diminish the election's ability to speak effectively. Because in order to speak, you need money. Some people caricature the court's cases in this area saying money is speech. That's not so. It's not that money is speech. Just like if somebody passed a law saying you can't donate money to your church and the court struck that down, it wouldn't strike it down because money is religion. You know, you could imagine contributions to a church being treated as religious practice, but even apart from that, in order for the church to function, it needs money. So restricting the spending of money on religion would be a restriction on religious practice. Restricting the spending of money to hire a lawyer would be a restriction on the right to counsel. Restricting spending money to educate your children would be a restriction on the right to private education. Likewise, restricting the spending of money on campaigns is a restriction on campaigning and campaign-related speech. Now, how does this restriction operate? Well, if I know that I might never get back the $400,000 that I want to loan to my campaign, I might be reluctant to loan it. On the one hand, of course, I want to get elected. On the other hand, you know, I have kids, I have a wife, I have a home, I have a mortgage. I may not be able to afford to just give the $400,000 away altogether. Or give away the extra amount past the $250,000. So I might say, look, I'm willing to risk the $250,000 because that at least could be taken care of through post-election fundraising. Anything beyond that, I'm going to be very reluctant to contribute to the campaign or to loan to the campaign. And therefore, as a result, the campaign will have less money and will be able to buy less speech. So this is a restriction, although not as grave as some, on the campaign's ability to speak. And it's not just the generally applicable law that applies to everybody, like, you know, tax law restricts my ability to speak because I have less money to speak with, but doesn't mean I can refuse to pay my taxes. But that law applies regardless of whether I'm a campaigner or a speaker or a candidate or whatever else. This law specifically targets loans to a campaign, which is to say it targets a particular kind of speaker. So here's what I think is the key question. It has to do with the risk of quid pro quo corruption, which is to say the risk that money given to a candidate or an office holder is essentially a kind of bribe. And by the way, there's a flip side risk, which is that it may be the result of a kind of extortion. So one way of thinking about it is something that rarely appears in campaign finance cases because it's so well settled. There are sharp limits on personal gifts to office holders as such, because the risk of quid pro quo corruption is seen as so high to allow sharp caps on personal gifts. My understanding for the Senate is, and I looked over the rules recently, $100 is the most you can give to a senator, but cash he can't give at all, or at least senator can't accept. There is, by the way, turns out a special exception or special waiver you can get for weddings. If you are a senator and you're getting married, you can ask for a waiver because, of course, it's the custom of giving and getting gifts at weddings. But in general, there's such a risk of quid pro quo corruption that even a total ban on cash contributions and a sharp limit on other gifts is considered proper. For campaign contributions, the court in Buckley v. Bellew upheld a limit at that time, $1,000, because of the risk of quid pro quo corruption. The risk is seen as high, but those gifts are less sharply capped, $2,900 per primary, $2,900 per general. So it'd be pretty high, a lot higher than for personal gifts. That turns out to be important. Interestingly, again, we rarely hear talk about it, but coordinated expenditures are treated the same way as campaign contributions. So if I call up the Cruz for Senate campaign and I say, you know, I'm thinking of putting out my own ads about why the senator should get reelected, what do you think would be a good thing for me to stress? That would be treated as essentially a form of contribution because that kind of coordination and cooperation is seen, among other things, as particularly likely to cause this risk of corruption. Independent expenditures, the court said controversially, but it did say that in Buckley and then has reaffirmed it since, the risk of quid pro quo corruption is considerably lower. And as a result, as a constitutional matter, they have to be unplugged. And of course, for candidates spending of their own money, there, whatever you might think about the egalitarian dimension of that, or the inegalitarian, the risk of corruption is the lowest, right? You know, I'm not going to bribe myself. And as a result, they're uncapped. And loans of own money are also uncapped. So the question is, how should we treat post-election contributions aimed at paying back candidates' loans? Now, it's clear they're not like independent expenditures. There's some risk of quid pro quo corruption seen with regard to them. But the question is, should they be treated more like campaign contributions, where you can give them up to the 5,800 cap, or maybe 2,900 cap at that point, because it's going to be it's with regard to the general campaign. It's complicated, but in any case, that level cap. Or should they be treated as personal gifts to the point that they're completely forbidden? Because the theory goes, is that once the money is given to pay back a loan, that's like money going into the candidate's own pocket. If I give money to a candidate for a future election, then that's going to be money that the candidate will find very useful, but they'll use it to speak in the future. Whereas if I give money to a campaign to pay back the loans, that's money that's kind of like a gift. It's kind of like my sending the guy a check, because that money is going to be directly beneficial to his personal finances, not just his political fortunes and ability to engage in political speech. So that's the question. The three-judge court struck that down for a variety of reasons, one of which it said is, you know, this concern about corruption is hypothetical. There isn't a lot of evidence of this, even though quite a few states don't have some similar limits. You'd think there'd be evidence available from those states, but there really isn't any, and whatever mentions there are brief and anecdotal and not really on point. So then one question, of course, is the perennial one of to what extent can these kinds of restrictions be justified based on plausible informed speculation? How much of that needs actual proof? Another point that the panel points out is they say, well, it's just not well tailored to it. Because after all, the 250,000 cap, you know, that could be plenty corrupting, and yet the law allows that. What's the point? Why is it, does it somehow become corrupting past the 250, but not below the 250? Maybe what's going on is they really are trying to go after just high levels of spending on campaigns, and that is not itself seen as a sufficient interest to justify restrictions. So that's the question that the court is going to have to deal with. It's possible that the court will use this as an occasion for broader pronouncements that will go beyond this pretty narrow issue, but it's also possible it will resolve it just on these particular terms. Probably an important point for a considerable number of candidates. Not a lot of candidates do this, but a considerable number do. But again, this is not by itself Buckley or even Citizens United. It deals with a considerably narrower question. So with that, I close.
Well, terrific. Thank you very much, Professor Bullock. Thanks to our other panelists as well. A reminder to our audience, if you have a question, we're open for questions now. Try and use the raise hand function on our program here, if you could. I see that we have one question pending, but before we get to that, let me ask a quick question, if I could, of Sarah Harris. And that is a question on timing on the OSHA case in particular. Sarah, you mentioned this case has been fast-tracked. It's sort of been wedged into the argument calendar. Do you have any predictions or any insights you can share on when we might expect a decision?
So I would say weeks, if not days. The reason is the OSHA rule is currently slated to take effect January 10th or so. Now, OSHA has said it's going to exercise enforcement discretion and at least until January 10th and maybe through February for some of the requirements. But I think the whole reason the court scheduled an argument for like 2 weeks for the stay applications was they are planning to get opinions out the door very, very fast.
Good. Okay. And just one quick factual question also for Professor Selman, and that is, as these people are being held indefinitely, are they free to return to their home countries or not? You're muted. You're muted, Ilya. You need to come up mute if you could.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Go ahead.
So it's a good question. What I would say is two things. One is, in some cases, it's not entirely clear that they are free, given that travel arrangements might be difficult or impossible to make, particularly during the COVID pandemic. The second is what these people are doing is, in fact, contesting the order of deportation. If they leave the U.S. or in their home countries, their legal status would change, and contesting the order would no longer be possible in the same way. And in other contexts, it would clearly be at least serious constitutional problems if we say, well, you are subject to indefinite detention unless you give up one of your other legal rights, including constitutional rights. So I think the same point should apply here.
Yeah, interesting. We've got a couple questions from the audience, but before we go there, I want to ask our panelists if they have any questions or comments, questions of their fellow panelists or comments on cases they didn't cover.
Actually, I have a question or a comment about for Eugene about the Shurtleff case. I know that the lower court case turned on the question of whether it's government speech, but I wonder whether you might agree with me that it might end up either turning on or at least heavily implicating the doctrines related to government treatment of religion, rather than just whether this is government speech. So let me sort of, I see this case as possibly of a piece with Carson v. Macon from the December sitting, which was asking whether Maine was required to fund sectarian schools when it funded non-sectarian schools for districts that didn't have a high school. And I think in both those cases, the court is likely to find that the government has to treat religion the same as it treats everybody else. That is, it has to fund the sectarian schools, it has to fly the Christian flag, and so on. And so the sort of the bottom line there is that the government, after those two cases, the government must not exclude religious entities from government benefits, including funding. Now, at the moment, that sort of mirrors what happens with government burdens, right? Under Employment Discrimination v. Smith, the government may, but need not, exempt religious entities from government burdens. But if the court overrules Smith, and I think they're going to sometime in the next couple of years, then what we'll have is a situation where simultaneously the government must exempt religious entities from government burdens and must not exclude religious entities from government benefits. What do you think of that, my prediction and the scheme?
Well, so I think the way the court is going to be dealing with various free exercise clause questions and relatedly what it has done with regard to establishment clause is a very interesting and important question, much more important than the question in Shurtleff itself. And we could have a discussion about that. I don't think this is itself clearly implicating in Shurtleff. Because the court has already made clear that when it comes to private speech that just is on government property, even if it uses government funds, even if it's funded by the government under a limited public forum, the government can't discriminate against religious speech. That was the Rosenberger case back in 1995. That's a very important holding. And that's why, if this is viewed as a limited public forum, the exclusion of religious flags would be seen as unconstitutional. But that principle has never applied to government's own speech. Certainly the court used to say that the government must exclude religious speech from its own speech. That's the endorsement test. That's been sharply cut back on with the Blandesburg Cross case just a couple of years ago, American Humanist Association, I think, versus American Legion. But still there's some element of that, right? That if the government probably may not permanently fly a flag outside of City Hall saying, Christianity is the religion of Massachusetts. I don't think it may be that even after American Humanist Association, that flag would violate the Establishment Clause. But even if it doesn't, and one could plausibly argue the government speech shouldn't be seen as violating the Establishment Clause, at the very least, the government doesn't have to do that, right? Doesn't have to allow people to do that if this is government speech. So that's why the real question is it or isn't it government speech? If it is government speech, then the government can discriminate based on viewpoint, including against religious viewpoints or against other viewpoints. On the other hand, if it is speech in a limited public forum, even if it's supported for, paid for, provided, the property is provided by the government, then we already know from Rosenberger that the government can't restrict religious speech. I oversimplified here, but basically that. So that's why I do think that's the core issue, although you're quite right that all these interesting and important free exercise and establishment clause issues are very much in play in the court now and very important. If I could just return with one comment on your presentation, it is a reminder of what I've recently recognized is the lawyer's true superpower, this whole debate about the choice of law rules and jurisdiction and all of that. And that superpower is the power to turn every legal question into a question about procedure. So hard to see a better illustration of that than the case you were discussing.
Very good. Any other questions, comments from our panelists directed toward their fellow panelists? Okay, again, if you're in the audience, use the raise hand function. We've got a couple questions pending. I'm gonna go to Carlos BTC. And through the raise hand function, if Brahm, our technician, could do that. Carlos, go ahead and make it a question, please, if you would. Go right ahead.
A very short question. On the FEC case, I was wondering if there was any consideration to the fact that you might not want a series set of transactions, of related party transactions, continuing on that might survive an election. I understand that $250,000 seems like a large or an arbitrary bar, but I guess at some point you'd want to settle whatever happened in an election and move on to the next one in some sense, because these are various problematic transactions, or would that never came up? Thank you.
Well, you could say, in fact, there's some arguments that I see in the briefing, at least the logical implication is, look, once you're elected, Once you're elected, now the risk of corruption is so great because now you're actually in office, even though, of course, you may have been incumbent before, but now you're actually in office. You might be inclined, or you might be especially in a position to pay back through your government action some of these contributions. And on top of that, anything that people give you after the election obviously can't be their way of joining together with others in order to fund speech about the election, because the election is now done. So the free speech interests are particularly reduced. So you could imagine something along those lines. The thing is that this restriction is very ill-tailored to just the concern about the election is done now. Now everything you're doing can't be about promoting future speech, because after all, you're perfectly free to donate money to retire debt of the campaign to other creditors. And campaigns often end up with having substantial debts to various service providers. So people are free to donate that money. Again, people are free to donate up to $250,000 that's going to go back to the candidate. So this is one of the ways in which narrow tailoring often operates. The narrow tailoring requirement of strict scrutiny, or so-called exacting scrutiny, applied in many election campaign cases. You say, look, you know, if your concern really seems to be about something, then it's got to be a pretty close fit to that thing. So if your concern is about just about the danger of any contributions after the election date, it's gotta look like you really are trying to do a lot about those contributions. And if all you're doing is about this one particular kind of contribution, then in that case, you need to explain why that kind of contribution is special. And of course, the government does. The government does say that the worry is that money is gonna go into the candidate's own pockets. But that's gonna be the argument that the court's gonna focus on, and not a broader argument, which doesn't seem to be well tailored to the broad permission of contributions after the election for retiring all sorts of other debt, or for that matter, contributions that will end up funding future campaigns.
Very good. Professor Volokh, you know, a lot of what I understand about campaign law is focused around the wealth of the individual candidate and whether that's a factor or not. How does that play in here, where it seems to me that the truck driver from New Jersey probably couldn't dump $250,000 of his own money into this. The billionaire from California doesn't need his $250,000 back. This might be a rule that affects people in the middle. Is that a factor at all in the court's analysis?
Well, so one of the things that the challengers, the Cruz for Senate campaign is saying is, look, this was enacted as part of this Millionaire's Amendment back almost 20 years ago now, and it really isn't about corruption. It's about the supposed unfairness of people being able to contribute money, and the court has contributed their own money, supply their own money, and the court has already rejected that as a rationale for restricting contributions or restricting contributions writ large, and therefore you should also reject this, rather than going into this quid pro quo corruption thing, which doesn't seem to have been the Congress's primary concern. So it may be that this was all about trying to limit the ability of the wealthy to use their own money, which the court has said is not a permissible basis. But you know, I have to say I'm not terribly persuaded by those kinds of critiques. I do think the quid pro quo corruption concern has considerable merit here, because it is true that if I give money to a candidate or to an elected official, especially. One, by the way, criticism of this rule is it applies even to people who lose, who aren't in a position to pay back the contributions with government action, because they're not going to be in the government. But setting that aside, if I'm giving money to somebody who's been elected, and it's being used to pay back a loan to him, that really is money into his own pocket. And it's true that's not going to be much of an issue for some candidates, because you know it's hard to bribe a billionaire with $5,900, right? You'd hope that at that point, they're even if they're bribable, it'd take more to buy them than $5,800, let's say. And it's impossible to bribe the truck driver because he doesn't have this loan that needs to be paid back. But it is possible to bribe people of substantial but not billionaire level means this way. And there's a plausible question whether we want to try to deal with that kind of bribery or that kind of implicit bribery, even if it's not the whole world of possible bribery. One reservation one might have about that rationale is that the $250,000 seems to be providing such opportunity for quid pro quo corruption for those people who are corruptible that it's hard to see why the next $150,000 would make much of a difference.
Yeah, I think Professor Silman has a question for you, Professor Bollock.
This is about the Shurtleff case, and I apologize if you covered this and I somehow missed it or misunderstood it, but I wonder if you could clarify what the nature of Boston's policy is. Is it that just in general, they've always allowed any flag that anybody might want to put up on that third flagpole, but then suddenly said, well, we don't like the Christian flag? Or do they have some kind of general policy that, you know, we only allow messages that comport with, you know, they're within a certain range? So for instance, if somebody said, I want to put up a Confederate flag or a Nazi flag or whatever, they would say, well, no, that, you know, that is not within sort of the acceptable range for this government controlled situation. Because it seemed to me there's a big difference between, you know, we have a limited range of things that we allow, like in the Sons of Confederate Veterans case, where, you know, they allow a lot of personalized license plates, but not the Confederate, not a pro-Confederate one, and perhaps not some others the state disapproves of, versus, you know, we've always allowed anybody, you know, to post anything, but now suddenly, you know, we reject the Christian flag, even though the Confederates, the Nazis, and so on would have been just fine.
So it's complicated, and I think it's complicated in part because, as with much that is done by organizations in their proprietary role, things sort of happen by practice more than overt rule. Of course, there is this dispute about whether this policy that accepts all applicants, whether it applies to the flagpole or not. That is a written policy. But if you say, no, that policy only applies to demonstrations at the flagpoles, which is to say on the concrete near the flagpoles, then what is the rule as to the flagpoles? The city says, we generally fly national flags to represent the city's diverse population, and fly non-city flags in association with publicly recognized days of observance. So that's, and then they say we occasionally raise in place of its own flag another banner honoring some day of observance, such as Veterans Day or a public institution or a moment of civic pride involving some football team and the like. But what I think they're really getting at is, you know, we fly flags that we think are going to build goodwill of a particular kind that we like. And we don't fly other flags. It's true, I think at the time they rejected the Christian flag, the so-called Christian flag, I don't think they'd rejected any other before, but their answer is because everybody else kind of understood what was going on. And I think that was pretty much what happened in Summum as well, that Summum didn't have a fixed policy, except these monuments and don't accept those. It's okay, look, you know, this monument, Ten Commandments, we like. This other monument, we don't like. The other monument, we like. We like them until we get to Summum's. We don't like that one. But we, as the government, get to choose. We don't have to come up with a rule of what we're going to say. We get to choose what we say. So, likewise, just to give an example, I don't believe that the North Korean flag had ever flown from the city of Boston flagpole, probably because nobody asked. If somebody had asked, you know, I think they probably would say, you know, North Korea is different. They just seem to be so, at least North Korean government, we love the people, but the government is so different that we're not willing to go along with that. We might not have gone along with the apartheid flag of the apartheid South African regime, or the Nazi flag when the Nazis were in charge of Germany. So I think their view is, it is government speech, and we're entitled to pick and choose without having to come up with a really sharp, crisp rule. In a sense, you might think of it the way, just the example we know, because we both teach at public universities, of government speech. You know, we organize, the university may organize conference, has speaker series, invite speakers. Now, there are, I think, important kind of diversity of opinion, constraints on that tolerance, academic freedom, and the like. But as a First Amendment matter, you know, the university gets to decide which speakers to invite and which panels to set up and who represents which views in which panel without having to have a crisp rule about them, because that is viewed as government speech. Whereas if they were viewed as private speech, then any restrictions must be viewpoint neutral and probably would have to be relatively crisply defined.
We've got another audience question. We're going to go to Robert Fitzpatrick, if we could. Robert Fitzpatrick, you're on. You might have to unmute your own system, Robert Fitzpatrick. We can't hear you. Robert, your sound is really breaking up, so we can't really make out what you're saying. So I'm afraid we're going to have to move on. Let me ask a question then, if I could, of Professor Sherry, and that is just a quick factual question that might not be part of the record. It might, and that is the value of the painting at issue here. I'm sure there's extraordinary sentimental value, but what are we talking about in terms of the value of the painting? And is this case going to have implications for other stolen Nazi, I don't want to call it Nazi art, but other art stolen by the Nazi regime?
Well, in terms of the value of the painting, I actually don't know. It may be in the document somewhere, but I didn't find it. Lily was actually paid the equivalent of about $360 for it in 1939. Technically she sold it. The Nazis insisted that she sell it to a German art dealer, but that was put in an account that she could not access. So she never did get her $360. She did get some money from the post-war German government. They set up a process for compensation and she got some money. Not an extraordinary amount, in the hundreds of thousands, I think. I don't know how much the painting is worth. In terms of implications for other cases, yes, it will have implications either in the Ninth Circuit or in the other four, and the choice of law will either be federal choice of law or state choice of law that will apply. Of course, you can't always figure out what that's going to do, right? You can't, whether it actually makes a difference. I mean, one of the arguments of TBC in this case is it doesn't make a difference whether you apply federal choice of law or California choice of law. Either way, Spain wins. In some circumstances, that could well be true, depending on the state choice of law doctrines, which of course differ from state to state. Where I think it might actually have a little bit more purchase, that is, I think this case is going to tell us a little bit more about how the Supreme Court feels about federal common law in general. And there is a case coming up, I forget the name of it, but it's, I think it's a question about, let me see if I can find it very quickly. A case coming up this term called Egbert versus Boole, or Egbert versus Boole. And that has to do with whether there is a Bivens cause of action for certain kinds of First Amendment violations. And that's federal common law. So if the court's opinion in this case comes down really hard on there is no federal common law except in very specific circumstances, that may tell us something about that case.
Well, thanks. I'm actually arguing that case, so that's fine. Okay. I also, just in case you're wondering, it's $30 to $40 million for the painting, so quite a bit of money. Far more than she received at any point in time, to put it mildly.
Right. No, that's an important point. Thank you. We got 2 minutes left. One quick question that I'd ask of anybody that cares to weigh in here, and that maybe cuts across sittings of the court. A couple of you have mentioned precedential cases that might or might not be overturned by the court in deciding the cases you described. I think, Eugene, you mentioned the Walker case, the license plate case, that might or might not be revisited. How does that, or does it at all, implicate or Dobbs, perhaps? In other words, are some justices going to be more or less anxious to overrule any other case at all, if they're more or less anxious to overrule Roe versus Wade? Does the court see things that way? Is there that sort of consideration at play?
You know, hard to tell in the abstract. All justices, including even Justice Thomas, was the one who's least committed to stare decisis. All justices have to accept some things as precedent, because otherwise you can't get the job done if everything is constantly up for grabs. Among other things, then all lawyers have to then come up, file all these cert petitions, sort of constantly asking for revisiting a decision that the court had rendered. On the other hand, I think virtually no justice says, you know, I will never reverse a precedent, especially in the constitutional context where they're kind of the only game in town for reversing precedent short of a constitutional amendment. So, you know, I do think there's a tendency, especially if some justices are at the very moment hammering away on how important stare decisis is in case A, becomes harder for them at the very same term while case A is pending to say, oh, but, you know, we'll reverse this precedent in case B. So you can imagine that. I don't think it quite goes the other way. I don't think it says, you know, somebody who's willing to reverse precedent in case A would then feel obligated to have to reverse precedent in case B, because among other things, cases are often so different that you could say, yeah, you know, I'm not committed always to stare decisis, but it's a good presumption and it's been rebutted in case A, but not in case B. So, but it's hard to talk about that in the abstract. Just I think it's hard to talk about stare decisis in the abstract.
Anybody else on this question?
Yeah. So my general take on this is that neither the conservative nor the liberal justices are really willing to maintain precedents that think are A, badly run, and B, that there, you know, will not be dire consequences from overruling those cases, that is dire, you know, upsetting of reliance interests and the like. So I think certainly stare decisis does weigh on them all in cases where they just think it's not badly wrong or the case just isn't that important. But in these sort of big high profile cases, I think a lot of the shadow boxing about precedent is actually a debate about whether the precedent was right or not. In some cases, perhaps a debate about if it was wrong, how badly wrong it was. I think it's relatively rare for justice to say we should maintain a precedent, even though I think it's badly wrong and it wouldn't cause any great harm to get rid of it. And I think actually justices should be willing to overrule precedents when those two points apply. I think there is some desire on the part of justice to be consistent in the way they overturn precedents or choose not to do so. But I also think these factors of how wrong it is and how big an effect it would have, or a big negative effect it would have if it got overturned, I think in many ways, these are the real factors in play, even though the court's official test for overruling precedent also includes some other stuff and only partly takes account of, you know, these two big issues.
Sarah Harris, we're over time, but I'm going to give you the final word.
Thanks. Just sort of two quick points. One, I think the court is, you know, whether formally or not, conscious of how many cases it takes in a given term to actually overrule particular precedents. Like, it is outwardly the question presented. And I think the court is kind of careful about how many cases, especially in a term with Dobbs, is going to take to overrule other big precedents. And that may play on the fate of the McGirt petitions that are up now. Certainly in the case we talked about Egbert, the court had an opportunity to grant on the question whether to overturn Bivens, didn't grant that one. But second of all, I think the real play in the joints is whenever the court encounters precedents like Walker that you know may or may not think might come out differently in the current court, the court has a lot of options beyond actually overruling them. It can certainly undercut those precedents and it can certainly reframe those precedents in ways that accomplish the practical result of making the holding a little different or a little less forceful than I think what one might have thought immediately after one of those decisions without actually having to overturn it. And I think that happens all the time. That's just part of interpreting precedents.
Very good. Well, my thanks to all of our panelists. We certainly appreciate your time and your effort in getting up to speed. I want to thank the audience as well and urge you, with regard to Professor Ilya Soman, buy the book on immigration. With regard to Professor Susanna Sherry, check out her followings on SCOTUS blog. With regard to Sarah Harris, follow her argument next month. And of course, with regard to Professor Volokh, check out the Volokh conspiracy if you haven't already done that. And to the audience, thank you for joining in. Thanks for your questions. Look for the Federalist Society website and your emails for future events. But until that next event, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.